This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we could be with you anywhere. But if you're ever in our town, New York City, let us know. We'd love to see you. Our program and this podcast are brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And by now, you should know me, right? Middle-aged white guy on the radio. Like this fellow here.
If you don't know me by now, you will never, never, never know me.
Is that guy singing that song by Melvin and the Blue Notes black? Nope. He's the very white lead vocalist from Simply Red, Mick Hucknall. It Ain't Right was originally recorded by black blues man Stuff Smith, but this is white Brit John Mayall covering it. Would anyone say that ain't right?
I'm super fly in the buttermilk.
And we find him say a hoot.
Cause I'm the black one.
I envy you so much. I want to be reincarcerated as a black man.
The Broadway musical Passing Strange from 2008 was all about racial and cultural identity and the idea of trading one's story in for another one, more interesting, more heroic, exciting, sexy, whatever the reason. And this is the issue that the by now very confused Rachel Dolezal has raised as she said goodbye to the NAACP Spokane, Washington chapter she was leading yesterday. She's white, according to her parents, but not according to her.
You know, if I was asked, I would definitely say that, yes, I do consider myself to be black.
That's Rachel speaking a few days ago to Sky News. And her statement in resignation suggests that the narrative of fighting against racism is still what she's all about. Please know I will never stop fighting for human rights and will do everything in my power to help and assist, she wrote yesterday, whether it means stepping up or stepping down, because this is not about me, it's about justice. But here is Dolezal speaking to NBC News today. Her strange claims about passing as black make perfect sense, she says, and aren't racist.
I have a huge issue with blackface. This is not some freak birth of a nation mockery blackface performance. This is on a very real, connected level. I've actually had to go there with the experience, not just a visible representation, but with the experience. And the point at which that really solidified was when I got full custody of Isaiah, and he said, "You're my real mom," and he's in high school, and for that to be something that is plausible, I can, you know, certainly can't be seen as white and be Isaiah's mom.
Rachel Dolezal speaking to the Today Show today. Isaiah, she refers to there, is her adopted son, who was also her brother by adoption when Rachel's white parents adopted him some years ago. Passing is the word that has been used to describe a black person presenting themselves as white. It was also what white author John Howard Griffin did, passing as black for 6 weeks to write his book Black Like Me back in 1961. Joining me now, Allison Hobbs, assistant professor in the Department of History at Stanford University. She's the author of A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in American Life. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, all I can say is wow.
Wow.
I mean, this is just right in your bullseye, I'd say.
It's been really fascinating. I mean, I think that some of Rachel Dolezal's comments even about the way that she's hoping to open up a conversation about race and racial identity were fascinating because I think that is what has happened. And there's been so much written about her story and so much written about the reaction to her story. And I think these are conversations that we really need to have.
Let's talk first about the anger at her. Where does that come from? And let's just stipulate that she's probably used some pretty questionable judgment in some
sure.
of the deceit that she's engaged in. But the whole idea of just doing this makes certain people, a lot of them African American, really mad. Why?
I've been really fascinated by that response to Rachel Dolezal because it seems as though she doesn't quite fit into the frameworks that we're sort of more familiar with. So as you began your show with this wonderful music And I think that that's one area where there has been this concern about this long history, you know, well before Simply Red and before some of the music that you play.
It's our history.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That this music is black music, and that there were white performers and white musicians who kind of appropriated black music and used it for their own fame and fortune and became very famous from it in a way that the original recorders and the original musicians did not.
So is the anger natural? Is this mixing a natural consequence of race issues being worked out in a society?
I think absolutely it is. It absolutely is. We live in a very multiracial society. To go back to the example of the music, we could argue that there was a period in the past, certainly, where white musicians became very wealthy from using the music of black mm-hmm. musicians. But now we can argue that, you know, there's lots of collaboration between black and white musicians all the time. So there's a constant change. And I think that's another important point to underscore, is that we don't live in a society where identity remains static or fixed, that things are always changing, that things are always moving. And that particularly when it comes to questions about identity or about race and racial identity, again, things are always in process, that things are not static.
Now, she's, you know, light-skinned. Mm-hmm. If you're white, I guess she's a little dark-skinned. And whatever she might have done to her complexion, she's on the edges. And there mm-hmm. are African-Americans who are on the edges, who are light-skinned. If you're in that sort of area where you can choose, mm-hmm. what's the history there? Because some folks on our website have said, she can choose, my relatives couldn't. And if you're a certain complexion, you're not going to be able to choose. What is the issue of being able to choose?
I think that really speaks to your earlier question about why there's anger about this. And I think part of the reason why there is quite a bit of anger is that there's a sense that she has this white privilege that will always allow her to make a decision to go back to being white. And that for most African Americans, that's not a possibility. So this idea that she could sort of step in and out of a white racial identity or a black racial identity is part of what I think creates this sense of anger, the sense that this is not fair, or that she can't really experience what it means to be black if she always has this white privilege that's allowing her to make choices that aren't available to most African Americans.
Do you know people who've passed for white?
Well, I don't know anyone personally,
right.
Partially because I think that people who do pass don't want to be known.
Right, exactly.
But in my family, what sort of inspired me to write my book was a story about a distant relative of ours who grew up on the south side of Chicago, identified as black. And when she graduated from high school, her mother insisted that she move far away from the south side of Chicago to Los Angeles to live as a white woman. And her mother believed that this was the very best thing that she could do for her daughter. She believed that she was opening up her life chances and her opportunities. So our cousin moves to Los Angeles. She doesn't want to, but she does move. She marries a white man. She has white children. No one knows any of her history. Mm. And about 10 years later, her mother calls her and she says, "You have to come back immediately. Your father's dying." And she says, "I can't come back. You know, I'm a white woman now. I can't go back. There's no way that I can go back to the south side of Chicago."
And you can hear that "I can't go back" in the hesitation and the strange sort of uses of language that Rachel is using.
Exactly.
There. She sort of acknowledges a level of deceit here, it seems, but there's also a not going back.
And I think that's part of what should increase the level of sensitivity towards her, possibly, is that I think she's really sort of taken off the table the idea of wanting to go back to a white identity. I think she's saying, "This has been my experience since I was 5 years old. I self-identified as being black. My father is not my white biological father, but my dad is this black man." Mm-hmm. I mean, she's really kind of contextualizing herself and really situating herself within the black experience.
Is part of this about we don't have a terribly nuanced understanding of what it means to be white? That there's some idea that like white is something clear, and that's really not the case.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that I think is troubling all around is that we really just don't have the language to discuss racial identity in the kind of complexity that we need to discuss it in. And you're exactly right about whiteness, because we sort of take whiteness as being this static, fixed identity, when in fact it really isn't. And particularly, I find it fascinating that, you know, given that we know about the history of passing and given that we know about people who are very light-skinned and look white, and which enables them to pass, and then we put up this picture of her as a child and say, you know, that's a white woman. Well, how are we certain of that? I mean, we now know that, you know, she is saying that when she was younger, she understood herself to be white by sort of society's definition.
But she's saying that I am my experience, right? Not just that picture with freckles.
Exactly. And even that picture with freckles could easily be a black person. I mean, so to use that picture as sort of here's the smoking gun,
right,
she's actually white, really
doesn't
meet the test. Yeah.
You know, there's also a kind of a cultural question here. In 2015, right, is it cooler to be black?
It's so interesting, because I think that again, is what creates the anger, that there's this sense that it is cooler. There's a sense that you get a certain type of credibility. You get a certain type of access to a kind of more exotic look, which is mm-hmm. what many people have also claimed, that she had certain privileges even when she identified as black because of her appearance. But, you know, I really think from listening to her that that's not at the root of it. I mean, I think for her, she's really saying, this is my experience. This is my identity. This is who I am. Perhaps I used the wrong language in saying I am black. You know, she should have said, I identify as black, even though I, you know, by society's definitions,
right,
would be white. But I don't think that this is an issue about, you know, kind of coolness. More so, I think it's an issue about how she sees herself and how she identifies. And it's very complex, as she repeatedly said, that her identity is very personal and it's very emotional for her. And it's not quite as easy as asking the question, are you white, are you black?
Is race biological or cultural?
Absolutely not biological. Absolutely cultural. It's a complete social construct. And the history of passing really demonstrates that. You know, the very fact that you can, you know, there's been lots of wonderful writing by very light-skinned African-American writers like Charles Chestnut, who talked about the kind of folly of these racial identifications, where you could be black in one state and then cross a state line and be white. You know, so what does that mean? I mean, clearly there can't be a biological basis. Race can't be based on skin color or blood if you can have someone who looks white but is black by society's definitions.
Allison Hobbs is assistant professor in the Department of History at Stanford University. She's the author of A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in American Life. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We're going to continue this conversation with your voices and thoughts coming up next.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So what do you think? Is race determined by biology or culture? Great debate happening on The Takeaway's Facebook page. Mike writes, if the portion of her life, referring to Rachel, that matters is the part after she had assimilated into black culture, why does she keep using made-up stories as the basis of her identity? If her identity is actually rooted in her experiences, why is this necessary? Shiva writes, who cares? This proves that race needs to be eliminated. If you want to be white, black, be black. Enough with diving everyone into hate-fueled resentment.
This is Amanda in Washington. Nothing is set in stone anymore. If you're not happy being a man, become a woman. If you feel sad because you're white, change your race to black. It's only about what makes us feel good.
Karen, I'm calling from Jaffrey, New Hampshire. And yes, I think it absolutely is defined by biology. A horse isn't a zebra just because someone paints stripes on it.
From Clinton, New Jersey, clearly race is determined by biology, just as sex is. The difference is how we feel about who we are. Some feel like men, women, trapped in a woman, man's body because of the psychological aspects of biology. But if one feels black or feels white, I'm pretty sure that's cultural indoctrination. Brittany on Facebook doesn't like the lines drawn between this conversation and the national conversation about transgender identity. Brittany says, I hate that people feel the need to drag transgender people into this conversation when the two are completely unrelated. Transgender people are assigned and conditioned into a gender they know is not right from birth. They do not choose to be transgender. It's just who they are. Dolezal has white ancestry, white parents. She chose to pretend to be black, to lie about her background, and pretend someone else was her father to back it up. I understand that you don't need to be black to hold office in the NAACP, but she obtained this position through false means and is essentially performing blackface.
This is Kate in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think government forms would say that race is biological. I think people are more complicated, but I think that we should all love who we are and appreciate what's unique and different about others without trying to deceive others.
I'm Michael Rosen from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Race is determined by culture. The DNA that determines your race has no consciousness or awareness. That all comes from culture. I'm certain of one thing only. I'm part of the human race.
Drive our show with your passionate debate. Keep the conversation going. Comment on Facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or just tweet us at The Takeaway. The president took a dunk in the Pacific last week, and not because he was vacationing in Hawaii or anything. The Pacific Trade Agreement is going to get another try. President Obama is working with Republican House Speaker John Boehner to find a way forward. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said Monday there are just some procedural differences to be worked out.
The president and the rest of us here at the White House continue to be confident that there is strong bipartisan support for this approach, and we just have to figure out how to untangle the legislative snafu in the House.
Snafu? Well, can Obama pass as a Democrat with all this horse trading on the trade bill with the GOP leadership? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. How's this going to work?
Well, legislative snafu, procedural snafu, is a great undersell from Press Secretary Josh Earnest, John, because what President Obama faced late last week was a resounding defeat in the House at the hands of his own Democrats who don't want this trade deal now. Now, fast-track authority passed the House 219 to 211, but that didn't matter because it is linked up closely with trade adjustment assistance, and that went down 302 to 126, not even close, not a legislative snafu. It's a rejection. Listen to this guy, Kevin Zeese. He's a lawyer and activist from Baltimore. He's part of an anti-TPP group called Popular Resistance. He was hanging outside the House yesterday with a bunch of protesters, kind of yelling at members as they walk by, and I asked him how he felt about the result last week.
When the morning started last week, we felt like we had the winning vote. Just from what we knew, we had a scorecard out here with all the names on it. We thought we had a winning vote. When Obama came up, we had doubts. But when Pelosi came out, we thought we had the winning vote again. We thought single digits. It was a landslide. That was a miracle.
So Kevin's doing a little nan-nan-nan-nan up there on the Hill.
Yeah, and they were to members as they were leaving the floor yesterday. There's been a lot of frustration also among these progressives, John, looking forward. Look, there is a presidential campaign that is bubbling in the background. Congress is still trying to legislate. They're resisting getting into the election mode where you can't pass anything because there's a presidential election afoot. But there's no doubt that the election is having a big effect on the votes on this issue. And really, let's be honest, it's on the Democratic side. Bernie Sanders, the progressive Democrat candidate, is stumping. He's against this deal. Elizabeth Warren's not running for president, but she's against it too. Sanders has been drawing bigger crowds than a lot of people expected. People are listening to him. And it's driven probably, you know, I don't know that he's flipping votes in Congress, but there's a lot more attention on this issue, perhaps than ordinarily there might have been. And progressives have been really mad, John, at one person, Hillary Clinton, who favored this deal when she was Secretary of State. Okay, part of her job. But they have been extremely frustrated that she hasn't taken a clear position either with them or with the president. Now, Hillary Clinton finally did take somewhat of a position over the weekend. Listen to what she said yesterday.
The president should listen to and work with his allies in Congress, starting with Nancy Pelosi, who have expressed their concerns about the impact that a weak agreement would have on our workers, to make sure we get the best strongest deal possible, and if we don't get it, there should be no deal.
Now that's, you know, a strong rhetoric, but she's really taking no position there.
She's taking no position on the actual deal, that's true,
right.
But she's clearly backing up Pelosi on what Pelosi did the other day, which is stop this thing dead in its tracks, 302 to 126. I want to stress to you again, this was no procedural snafu. This was a defeat. Now, you did not hear Hillary Clinton take a position on the Trans-Pacific Partnership or on Fast Track, which is what a lot of Democrats want her to do. She didn't do that, but she is backing up Pelosi here. So, John, where does this go? There was talk that there might be a revote on trade adjustment assistance, the necessary part to get Obama's trade deal passed as soon as today. That's not going to happen. They can't flip 90 or 100 Democratic votes in the span of a couple of days. The House is voting today. It is a procedural vote. And what that procedural vote is going to do is give Barack Obama and John Boehner another 6 weeks until July 30th to bring up a revote, buy them some time to see if there's a way to get these things passed. They have to pass both trade adjustment assistance and fast track to get these things to the president's desk, or else it can't pass Congress. And right now, they don't have a way to do it.
And with a serious compromise to move the needle there, that's really going to be hard to see. But we'll see between now and the end of July. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
So we're at halftime here at The Takeaway. You want to stick around for the second half, of course. A reminder, we are on Twitter, at The Takeaway. Please do follow us there. And you can follow me, at Jay Hockenberry. I'll answer your tweets. What you're listening to is really only made possible by those who contribute to public radio. If you do, thank you. If you don't, please think about giving whatever you can to your local public radio station. They need it, and you'll feel good about being part of a community that values stories like this. You might say these Lithuanians are trying to pass as Russians, but they aren't calling themselves Russians. We support Udia, protesters are chanting, in a war game exercise in Lithuania with the message that if Russia tries anything in the Baltic states, like what happened in eastern Ukraine, Moscow can expect a swift response, a lightning response, in fact. And that's what Vice News reporter Henry Langston observed when he went to Lithuania to exclusively witness Operation Lightning Strike, the four-day war games exercise that was the first drill to prepare Lithuania's newly formed Rapid Reaction Force for such a Russian attack. Langston says the exercise was designed to give Russia pause without making them mad at Lithuania, hence the fake name, Udia.
These sort of events in eastern Ukraine last year and this year have sort of put those Baltic states on edge. That's Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia. They're sort of EU states, also members of NATO. But given that Russia used protecting of Russian speakers in those regions as a pretext for that intervention, it's the same sort applies to the Baltic states. All three states have Russian-speaking minorities, and they fear that that could be used against them in the future.
Now, you observed Lithuania attempting to show some force here in the form of a war game. Is this purely symbolic, or could Lithuania, with the military tools at its disposal, actually buy some time if suddenly Russian uniforms or those, you know, strange anonymous green uniforms show up on the Lithuanian border?
I mean, that's the sort of point of the exercise, is to try and at least make sure that the Lithuanian military is capable of buying some time. I mean, in terms of the exercise, it was aimed around this idea of hybrid warfare, sort of foreign-backed armed insurgents taking over government buildings and infrastructure points and causing trouble on the border, that sort of thing, that the Lithuanians believe that they could handle and get a hold on. But if it became a sort of more conventional large-scale invasion, this rapid reaction force that they created last year probably would not be able to buy the country that much time, and they'd have to sort of ensure that, or hope that, their NATO allies would step in to intervene at some point.
Well, let's try to get a feel for how realistic this was. Listen.
There will be a kind of, you know, little skirmish here, and we will look for reaction from our own forces. but we do not know what happens next. Right? That's a part of the game.
So that's one of the opposing forces' vehicles. And now there are some armed men now coming out of the vehicle and firing towards the Rapid Reaction Force.
Now, Henry, you've had some experience with this in real live war zones. How realistic was this, and how much of a sense did you get that this was actual tactical maneuvers versus, you know, some sort of theater?
I mean, the Lithuanian military are pretty well drilled. They're well supplied, modern weaponry to an extent, and more so than the Ukrainian forces I've observed over there. It's as realistic as I think as these sort of exercises can really be. This was the first real nationwide test of the Rapid Reaction Force, so it was more about seeing how they coordinated with local police forces and also sort of police forces, the Ministry of Interior, so the National Police. Some of the drills, some of the techniques they were using were very realistic, but ultimately they're not being shot at for real.
And the real thing, I mean, that's the other kind of bizarre element here. On the one hand, you know, a simulation is not an actual war, but if there were to be an actual war in Lithuania, the opponent could only be one country. It can't be Uganda, and it can't be, you know, the state of Florida. It's definitely going to be the Russians. How do they handle that?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, that the Lithuanians have quite a close relationship with the current Ukrainian government. You know, they're trying desperately to observe those tactics used by the pro-Russian forces and the Russian regular forces in Crimea and eastern Ukraine as much as possible to get an idea of what might happen if a similar sort of thing happened in Lithuania. These are difficult scenarios to train for and to practice for. But I think from what I've observed, I think they've got off to a good start. And they will always be essentially now one step ahead of any sort of pro-Russian separatist movement or whatever it is, because at least they'll have some sort of force designed to deal with it. And this is just basically what the Ukrainians didn't have.
But they don't call the opponents Russians in this simulation, right?
No, it's funny because the rhetoric coming from the Lithuanian government is very sort of, it's quite obvious that they see Russia as a threat. But in terms of the exercise, they gave Russia a different name. The sort of the aggressors in the exercise were from the fictional state of Udia. And so, you know, a completely separate flag, a whole bit of backstory behind the leader of this country. So, yeah, they're making sure that they're not going to cause a diplomatic incident with this kind of exercise. But ultimately, it's quite obvious who they're really talking about.
I mean, it's absolutely artificial countries, and it has nothing to do with reality. That's the main idea we say during every kind of exercise.
So we're definitely saying that that's not Russia right there?
Absolutely.
But we are saying that's Latvia there. That's no problem.
That's no problem. That's Latvia.
So who is that you're speaking with there? The ringmaster of the circus or some actual official in Lithuania?
So he's one of the Lithuanian commanding officers of the Rapid Reaction Force. And so his job is more of a back in the HQ, checking over the progress of the exercise, but also a bit of, you know, press liaison. I mean, as far as we were aware, we were the only foreign press covering the event.
Henry Langston, any evidence during your reporting of NATO buildup over there, or the idea that has started to be reported this week that the U.S. may be preparing for as many as 5,000 troops to be supported by war materiel that's being sent to the front lines, including possibly some of the Baltic countries?
Well, we didn't sort of observe any build-up. There's sort of, obviously, you can see a lot of the American-made weaponry, tanks, APCs, that sort of thing. But I wouldn't say we observed a build-up. We know that over the past year there's been an increase in NATO military flights across the Baltic airspace. So we sort of could see this coming so that, you know, the defense of Europe can be a strong one from the start.
Some of the ground views of what looks like a new 21st century Cold War. Henry Langston is a reporter for Vice News, just back from Lithuania. Henry, thanks so much.
No worries. Thank you.
You can find a link to the Vice News episode, "The Russians Are Coming, Lithuania's Operation Lightning Strike," at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Japanese, Java, and juggling. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer.
Ah, summery summer, the season of song. Gag me with a summer song like that one from the late 50s, Summer Place.
Summer breeze makes me feel fine.
Or there's this one from the 70s. Makes you want to pick up a snow shovel. Ah, the artistic crimes of pop music committed in the name of summer. Well, our friends at Soundcheck are on the lookout for a fugitive in 2015. Where's our summer song, huh? Where is it? The hot number that could even melt down that little Disney snowman. Soundcheck's John Schaefer is taking suggestions all week on the lookout, and he's determining a champion based on listener votes. He's here to help us understand the peculiar musical muse of summer. John Schaefer, why do we even need to go here? We've got Summer Place. We've got Summer Breeze. How do you top those? We're done.
Those aren't even on our list of contenders for the ultimate summer song.
Well, we need a summer song for this year, that's for sure. There's nothing really out there.
Not yet, which is surprising, because normally we've heard the song of the summer by this point. But what we're talking about today is are the songs that survive their initial summer and become kind of perennials. To use a gardening metaphor, there are lots of annuals. You know, a song will come up. It'll be the song of 2004 or the song of 2010. We're looking for the songs that are coming back year after year.
Timeless elm trees or oaks of summer, yes.
Well put, John.
Well put. All right, so give us your first one.
Well, like, you know, the Love and Spoonful song, Summer in the City. I mean, come on. Hot Town, Summer in the City. Back of my neck getting dirty and gritty.
Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk hotter than a match here.
It's such a humid, summery. You feel hot just listening to it.
Now, wasn't this kind of protest-based? I mean, wasn't this sort of political, this song, originally?
Well, I don't think so, but it's funny you should mention that because another one of our contenders is a song that accidentally became associated with the political movement of the 1960s with inner-city riots and things like that, and that's the Martha and the Vandellas song called Dancing in the Streets. It was a completely innocent kind of summer experience. The song is about watching kids in Detroit playing in the water from a fire hydrant in the street. And it became kind of adopted as an anthem in the middle, late 60s, to the bemusement and consternation, really, of Martha Reeves, who, when asked about it, said, "Oh, Lord, it's just a dance song." I mean, that was her exact quote. "It's just a song about dancing."
There's a certain irony in it being associated with those times, but I remember it that way. I mean, I grew up with this song, and it was always associated with those hot summers of the 60s.
And I think that might have kind of made it a summer song after the fact. You know, I think it took a few years for that kind of association with this song to fade away before it could really kind of take its place in this list of perennials that comes back summer after summer.
Any deliberate summer song, a song that maybe never intended to be eternal, that clearly was going for that summer moment that lasted.
I think Alice Cooper's stroke of genius was identifying the end of the school year as a seasonal thing that happened every year that did not have a song.
When we got no choice, all the girls and boys making all that noise, 'cause they found new toys. Well, we can't salute ya, can't find a flag. If that don't suit ya, that's a drag.
Smooth
looking for a song that, you know, his first thought was Christmas. But that's such a crowded field. And here he was identifying something that everyone looked forward to every year.
When you listen to that, it sounds like he's talking about we're all going to prison, but actually we're being released this summer.
It's the release from prison. Yes. That, I mean, how many generations of kids now, since the early 70s, have sung that chorus, "School's out for summer"? I mean, it is, as I said, genius.
My kids.
And that sort of goes to one of the other things about this kind of the ultimate song of the summer. It's something that has to span generations. Not just it survives its summer, but, you know, now we've got a second or even third generation of kids who sing "School's out" every year.
Sure.
And also, you need to have some kind of sing-along quality. You need a chorus that people just feel like singing when they're tooling on down the highway with the windows rolled down. And "School's Out" certainly has that.
What other songs? I mean, there's certainly a lot of songs with summer in the title and a lot of songs with summery stuff in
the
title.
Yeah, you know, with a song like, I mean, to take a recent example, it's very hard to determine which of the summer songs that we've had in the past, say, 5 years are going to still be with us 5 or 10 years down the road. But, you know, one that has as good a shot as any is the song "Get Lucky" by Daft Punk. There's nothing overtly summery about it, but if you go back to the "Love and Spoonful" song, you know, the chorus is, "At night it's a different world, go out and find a girl." Here's the girl of that song, you know, she's out all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky. We're up
all night to get lucky. All right, so how does everybody get involved in your longitudinal attempt to identify the perfect summer song?
Well, we have put together a list of the major contenders, the classics, and some of the more recent contenders, possibly. And it's real simple. Just check your favorite, the one that you think is the ultimate song of the summer, and we will tally up the results and report back.
Does the Vivaldi summer movement from the seasons have a chance?
It did not make our list. Really? I suppose you could write it in.
Maybe I will.
We're really talking about pop songs that pass the windows down test. You know, certainly the Daft Punk song does that, but I'm not sure the Vivaldi does.
Vivaldi with the windows down. It sounds like a band. John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC, and you can go to thetakeaway.org to vote and be a part of all of this. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. We're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get
lucky. We're up all night to get lucky. And you're taking our conversation on race with you today. Colin from Gainesville, Florida. Ms. Dolezal's case reminded me of a quote by the sociology professor Ruben Rumbach that race is a pigment of our imagination. While there are certain physical characteristics inherent within each racial group, these are becoming less overt and less dichotomous with immigration and acculturation. And Ms. Dolezal is a prime example of how a good wig and a bottle of self-tanner can so successfully reclassify traits that we so vehemently hold to be biologically determined.
Hi, my name is Mary. I'm from Portland, Oregon. And as far as the topic today, I would say that race is determined by biology. No matter what race you are, there are so many ways in which a person can enrich a community without trying to be something that you're not.
That's all for today, but keep the conversation going. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can find me at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.